copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So why am I here talking about science communication? Well, this stems directly from the work that I do at Tyndale House. Tyndale House, as you've heard, is a Bible research institute, and we focus on the more technical side of studying the Bible, so the structure of the original languages of the Bible. We look at the historical context of the Bible and what we can learn about that. So that enables us to do things like track the journey of the Bible from the ancient world to the modern world. You know, Isaiah did not have a USB drive. How have we got it today? So we look at those sorts of things, how the Bible was copied faithfully by scribes over millennia. We can look at some of the historical events in the Bible and verify them independently from other historical sources outside of the Bible. And we can analyse the authenticity of the documents of the Bible as history, as documents of history, and to contextualise the Bible. I was having a conversation the other day with one of our scholars who's an Assyriologist, so he studies ancient Mesopotamia, or Babylon, as we would think of it. And he was talking to me about, we think about the exiles through the view of the Israelites as exiles, but he can look at the exile through the view of the people who exiled, and like, why did they do that? So we can look at some biblical context. My job is to take this quite academic, quite technical research and communicate it at a popular level. So I always say, the person in the street, the person in the pew. That's what I'm looking to communicate. And we're passionate about doing this, because although it's quite technical information, we think it can strengthen Christians' sense of their faith, help them to know. I mean, John's video yesterday was all about how do we know the Bible is reliable. So it's that kind of work that we do. So we're really passionate about it. We think it could help people. But when I come to communicate it, there is a problem. I had a conversation with one of our scholars who is an evangelist, and I had this conversation with him, and I said, and I was talking to him about how we best communicate. And he said, Kay, your problem is this. In all my years as an evangelist, nobody has ever said to me, how do I know that the Bible is true? No one's ever actually asked me that question. So what we have at Tyndale House is detailed, thoughtful, helpful answers to questions that the public generally don't think to ask. So how do we bridge that gap? So I put on the handout, we have a detailed message in a soundbite world. You know, ask any politician, how do we talk about nuanced things in a culture that will only receive 140 characters or less? So I had that conversation, I went away, I thought about it, and so I came back and I said, okay, put a pin in that for a minute, forget for a minute that we're going to struggle to communicate this, and let's imagine what would happen if we could communicate it. Like, is it worth it, or should we just leave the academics to their books? And I said, you know, imagine what difference would it make to you as an evangelist if, when you looked out over your audience, everybody in the room believed that Jesus was a real person who existed. Currently in Britain, 1 in 4 18 to 24 year olds don't believe that Jesus was a real person who really existed, which has been proven beyond reasonable doubt by both secular and Christian academics. So imagine if that was the case, if actually everyone in the room believed it. Imagine if, when you talked about the Bible, people, just the Christian and non-Christian, thought, yeah, the history's accurate. I can see that the history's accurate. You know, and his eyes lit up. He was like, that would be amazing. That would be a game changer for evangelism. So then the question becomes, is it possible? Is it possible to communicate a detailed message in a soundbite world? So I went away and thought again. And I came back and I said, it must be, because scientists do it. And if scientists do it, then we can do it. And he's like, okay, you're going to have to explain that to me. So I said, first of all, scientists have a detailed technical message. Secondly, they are often answering questions that nobody thinks to ask. You know, I've seen science programs about how stars are formed. I do not lie in bed wondering about how stars are formed, any more than I think, you know, the average person in the street lies in bed thinking, I wonder if the Bible's reliable. If you lie in bed thinking about that, you either probably need to get out more or come and work at Tyndale House. The other thing that I think is a parallel between science communication and Christian communication is that scientists are generally, they're communicating knowledge, but really they're communicating something else underneath. As one of my friends who's a scientist put it fairly succinctly, what we really want to say is, please give me some funding. What we actually say is, oh, look at this, it goes bang. So there is often an underlying message that scientists want to communicate, and that's generally either my research is worth funding, or it could be someone who works in health science saying, change your lifestyle, this is important. Or, for instance, I mean, a lot of scientists are very, very concerned about climate change. So there's a lot of science communication, which is actually about climate change, but there's also communicating a whole other sort of level of scientific knowledge on top to sort of convince you about the climate change. I think there are some scientists, and we'll come to one in just a minute, who I think are trying to, they're talking about science, underneath, I think they're trying to disprove the existence of God. So I think we have some really strong parallels. But scientists manage to go deep into their subject without losing their audience. So how do we do that? So I want to think a little bit, first of all, about how scientists do this. And we'll just have a look at some of the concepts. And then I'd like to break in the middle and take some discussion and have some questions. And then I've got some, we can have a bit of fun. I've got some quite fun examples of some of the kind of weird and wonderful things that scientists do to communicate. So how have scientists been successful in this? And the first thing, and this is a little bit depressing in some respects, is just they have worked really hard. You know, there is no shortcuts to this kind of communication. Scientists have poured extraordinary amounts of time and strategy and energy and resource into messaging. I did a quick survey of British universities that are the ones with the biggest science reputations. At almost all of them, of the British universities with the best reputations for science, almost all of them, you can do a postgraduate MSc in science communication. So there is a career path from undergraduate straight into a science communication MSc, and then you go on to your career in science communication. Imagine if every major university in the UK had an MA in Christian communication. You know, I think that would put us in a different place on the map. So this has been resourced really carefully. Speaking to scientists, I mean, I spoke to, in doing some research, I spoke to a cosmologist, I spoke to a health statistician, I spoke to a research chemist. And when I said, I'm thinking about doing something in science communication, they immediately went, it's huge, it's growing, it's massively important, it takes up a significant part of our budget, it's right at the forefront. So scientists have done this by putting in the work, and I think it's important for us to recognise that. There's also organisation beyond education. So in the UK we have an organisation called STEMPRA, which is a public relations organisation specifically for science communicators. It has 650 members and programmes that run throughout the year. Imagine if everybody across Europe who was involved in what we can genuinely call public relations about faith was part of an organisation. I mean, what an organisation that would be. So what are they learning from all of this? They've studied, they've put the work in. What are they learning? I was trying to think about how to encapsulate this, and then I didn't have to because Tony did it yesterday for me. Tony said yesterday, he said this, it's our emotional response to something that matters more than facts in a post-truth environment. I'm going to say that again. It's our emotional response to something that matters more than facts in a post-truth environment. And that's a real challenge if you're a scientist. Scientists are all about the facts. But in order to communicate the facts, scientists have embraced the emotional side of life. I would say the darling of science communication in Britain at the moment is a vocal, potentially even militant atheist called Professor Brian Cox. He's extraordinary at this. He is a particle scientist at the University of Manchester. He does a lot of work about how the universe was formed. And I think underlying this is a sense that he wants to kind of loosen belief in creation. But often he doesn't talk about that specifically. Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. But he is great at harnessing the power of our emotions. Now, I was going to show you a clip, but then I got a bit worried about copyright. So I'm going to try and demonstrate what he does anyway. Brian Cox, he's become a little bit of a cliche in the way he does his documentaries. He always starts off... Oh, we might need lights off. Is that okay? Sorry. He always starts off with some kind of sweeping panorama. I don't know if you can just make him out there on a mountain. He does a lot of standing on mountains. Often there's only like a few seconds. I don't know how much those few seconds cost of flying a mountain up a mountain. Often he's speaking about things like how stars are formed. So often there's something a bit like this. I don't know what that is. I'm not a scientist. But there's a blue one. So there's often something like this. And what you've got to imagine is sweeping panoramas and lights in the sky. And then there'll be the music. And on comes the music. And it comes up with the violins to a crescendo of brass. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. And then the oratory comes. And this is taken from Life of the Universe, which is one of his programs about how the universe began, he thinks. And he says this, and then his voice comes over, and he says this. Did our universe have a beginning? Why is there a universe like this one? If time began at the Big Bang, then was there a time before time? Why are there rivers and flows and filaments of galaxies? Is there an end of the universe, or is our universe eternal? By the end of which you are eating out of his hand. You know, and he has really embraced this idea that if you want to engage with the public, dry facts are not going to cut it. And I've really thought about this from a Christian perspective, and I've thought, but what could we do that isn't sort of emotionally manipulative? And I think the Christian equivalent of Brian Cox is Handel's Messiah. You know that moment when you stand up and you go, and I defy anybody not to weep a tear at the beginning of Handel's Messiah. And yet there is Christian truth in there. So who is the Handel in this room that can do this stuff? So that's the first thing, public engagement. The second thing that scientists have been incredibly smart at is learning to make sure that the media is accurate in the way that it reports science. And again, massively organised about this. There are really strong parallels here as well. So the Chartered Institute of Public Relations in the UK in 2013 did a report into science communication generally. And one of the things they identified was the decline in the number of specialist science journalists, which they see as a real problem in accurate reporting of science. I worked at the Sunday Times for a span of about 9 years. And I think the whole time I was there, Sunday Times is the biggest selling broadsheet newspaper in the UK. In the whole time I was there, in the Sunday Times itself, there was not a specialist journalist for faith. And so there is a real parallel there in that we're losing our specialist journalists. I think it's actually getting a bit better in faith now. So there's the decline of specialist journalists. The other parallel, I think, is that both science communicators and Christian communicators deal in the controversial. The job of a scientist is to challenge the status quo. Christians are often butting up against the cultural norms. So I think there's a real parallel there. One of the most intriguing parallels, though, I think, is about negative stereotyping. Now, I think as Christians, we tend to think we've cornered the market on negative stereotyping and that actually we're the ones who are negatively stereotyped. So it was really interesting to read that scientists are really concerned about negative stereotyping of scientists. The whole looking like Einstein and blowing things up. This guy is called Jean-Luc Dumont, and he is an engineer with a PhD in applied physics, but he now works full-time as a trainer of scientists. And he described the negative stereotypes that he thinks scientists get. And he says this: scientists are a little weird, and the things that happen to them aren't like the things that happen to other people. And in their weirdness, we worry they may be a little dangerous. When you meet scientists in books, usually the main character is trying to prevent them from doing something well-meaning but totally disastrous. And have you noticed how scientists look? They are all old men with a lot of facial hair. And the women have something psychotic about them. And, you know, that's his view of the negative stereotyping of scientists. So I think there are lots of parallels between media, how we're trying to handle the media, and how scientists are trying to handle the media. So how have scientists gone about this? In their customary organised way. This is the Science Media Centre. Now, this exists in the UK, but there are science media centres across the world. They call themselves an independent press office, helping to ensure that the public have access to the best scientific evidence and expertise through news media when science hits the headlines. So essentially, they're a group of people that journalists can go to and say, give me the baseline facts. You're impartial. I trust you. Just give me, you know, before I interview somebody, just tell me, just give me the lie of the land, as it were. The other thing that the Science Media Centre does is if you've got a controversial, if you're a journalist with a controversial subject, they will give you people on both sides to talk to about that. And that's been going for years, absolutely years, and is really credited with raising the standard of science journalism in the UK. So that's at the sort of big organised level. There's also some fun stuff going on at the more grassroots level. This is a website called Bad Astronomy. And this is one of a suite of bad science blogs, which are run by scientists who survey news media and popular culture and Hollywood and song lyrics. And they look for instances where science is misrepresented or factually incorrect. And then they call it out on their blog, sometimes hilariously. And there's also a good Twitter feed attached to this. This is the Bad Astronomy page on astrology. And rather delightfully, it says, before I even start a note, this page is my attempt to show that astrology has no basis in reality whatsoever. And he goes on to kind of paste astrology. And there's a number of those. And on this point, I would say there is good news. This is the Religion Media Centre. Now, this was launched 2 months ago by a journalist in Cambridge who saw the Science Media Centre and thought, we need one of these. If you don't have one of these in your country, this is what we need to do. Okay, so media engagement. So I want to break in a minute and have a little time of discussion before we go into the examples. But I think, first of all, I just wanted to think about what we can learn from science communicators. And I think for me, the biggest thing I think we can learn from science communicators is that there is space for us to wear a different hat in the public square. What do I mean by that? I think, generally speaking, when we see Christians in the public square, they are butting heads with the culture. You know, that's when we get invited in. And you know, to be fair to journalists, that's quite good practice. You know, if you have a controversial story, you've got to have one. You know, a good way of giving balance is show both sides, or essentially, you know, get the opposing arguments on, bring them on, and get them to fight it out. But I think the problem, if that is all that we have, if that's the only invitation we're getting as Christians, I think that raises some problems. I think, first of all, it makes people think that we only care about sex and death, because I think we generally get invited when it's an issue of sexual morality, beginning and end of life issues, maybe a bit of poverty. That's where you see Christians. That's your slot. And they are really important issues, and we should be in the public square talking about those. We really should. But if that's all we do, then I think, first of all, we give the impression that being a Christian is mostly about sex. And I think the second thing is that it gives the impression that Christians are mostly combative. And I really like for us to break out of that and see if we can create some more space in the public square. This is Dr. Tom Kitchen. He works in the Space Science Laboratory at University College London. He's also a former researcher on Horizon, which is the BBC's flagship science programme. He gave me his crib sheet about what secular science journalists are looking for, and I'll share that with you because I think there are some parallels. But he said this, which I think is interesting. Scientists have become aware of the value of separating themselves out into those who present observable facts and those who communicate interpretation or the political layer. For example, David Attenborough, who is a nature journalist in the UK, won't talk about issues he's passionate about, such as climate change or the buildup of plastics in the ocean, until the very end of the series, creating a separation between the facts and the practical outworking. So scientists have realised that there is a bit of public mistrust around people with a strong agenda. People kind of, they just view them differently. That's why in newspapers we have news on one page and we have comment on a different page, because you view it differently. What I think is happening in the Christian communication realm is we've got plenty of people in the opinion column and actually not enough in the news column with just, here's some information. So what that looks like for us at Tyndale House, for example, is that we need to interrogate our research and say what's just fascinating and not controversial. I think the journey of the Old Testament from the ancient to the modern is just fascinating, whoever you are, in the way that how a star is made is fascinating, whoever you are. And I think we need to interrogate those. I think we need to find the human interest stories and just try and occupy a different space in the public square with those. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that I think it's worth communicating knowledge about the Christian faith, about the church, for the sake of it, even if it doesn't look as though it's directly evangelistic. And scientists, and this is exactly what scientists do, they want to communicate about man-made climate change, but they start off talking about the rainforest. Because they know, so this is what they want you to believe. This is that they want you to believe that climate change is man-made and that we need to change our behaviour to fix it. But they know that if you think the rainforest is truly beautiful and that it's under threat, or that the marine ecology is under threat because of plastics in the ocean, once you believe that, you are more willing to believe, I must change my life because this is serious. Scientists call this gateway belief. What is the belief that is a gateway into faith? I think believing that Jesus was a real person who lived and died is a gateway belief to Christianity. I think believing that the Bible is broadly true as a historical document is a gateway belief to faith. What are the gateway beliefs and how can we promote them in a non-combative way? I'm going to hold it there for a second, and I thought I'd just break in the middle if we can have some discussion and questions, if we have any. And then I've got some kind of fun, slightly wacky examples of how scientists are actually communicating that we can all really enjoy and then scare ourselves with. I think there is more creativity that we can throw at this than we realise. So with that, I'm going to segue into part two. Thank you very much. And we're going to look at some of the things that scientists are doing. So one of the things that scientists are very hot on is communicating with children. They're very strategic. And that means being very simple in the way that they communicate their message. And so scientists have got some quite fun tools. I'm not sure I necessarily suggest you try this one, but it's quite fun. This is a tool called Simple Writer. And what you can do is you can write a message into the box and it will scan it and show you any words that aren't in the top 1,000 most used words in the English language. What is really fun is try to write the gospel in that box with no red words. So this is just kind of a fun tool that scientists use to say when we're communicating with children, we've got to use simple language. When I talk to academics, they go, oh no, I can't, my subject is too complex, so I'm not going to be able to do that. To which the Simple Writer people say, This is a diagram of the Saturn V rocket and how it works, made entirely with the 1,000 most used words in the English language. And they have to call it Upgoer 5 instead of Saturn rocket, because neither the words Saturn or rocket are in the most used words. So this is the fuel tank, and it says, this is full of that stuff they burned in lights before houses had power. That's gas. There's one over here which says the bits at the bottom, the boosters, are this end should point towards the ground if you want to go to space. If it starts pointing towards space, you are having a problem and you will not go to space today. So that's just a fun one. But we must remember, of course, when we're communicating about Christian things that are maybe new to other people, we need to keep it simple. On to some of the more creative things that scientists have done to try and engage the public in new ways which they may not have thought of. This is one of my favourites. Oh, we might need the lights off or else we won't see this. Sorry. This is a website called Galaxy Zoo. And Galaxy Zoo is set up by a group of scientists who they're basically what they do is they look at the structure of galaxies and they analyse them to find out more about space. Apparently galaxies look different, they're a different shape in different parts of space depending on what's going on around them. So that's what this group of scientists do. There are 100 billion galaxies that scientists know about so far, and each one is made up of a billion stars. In order to analyse the galaxies, they need to know 5 basic things about what shape they are. So here they're asking, do they have spiral arms? This is a really boring one. Sorry, I should have picked a more interesting galaxy. So basically what happens is they put a picture of a galaxy on the website and they invite members of the public to analyse them. So here they're saying, does it have a spiral pattern? Can it be viewed from the side? The reasons they do this are twofold. It's called a crowdsourcing data project. The reason that they get members of the public to essentially provide the data for their research is, first of all, that computers aren't very good at doing this, so actually they do need people to do it. But secondly, and way more importantly, what better way to communicate something about, you know, star formation and the latest science in cosmology than getting people to actually do the research with you? And it's not just that you can go on the website and answer the questions. There are message boards where the scientists will interact with the members of the public who are doing the research. And it's just like you're really motivated to sort of find out about it. I did about 3. It was really good fun. And then I was like, why do you want to know if it's got spiral arms? So I kind of clicked through and like, oh, fascinating. Because it tells you how old the galaxy is, apparently. So that's Galaxy Zoo. Science communication in terms of research engagement has gone through 3 distinct phases. The first phase was, we've got information and we're going to tell you. Phase 2, which was a bit better, was we're going to listen to how you like to be communicated with, and then we're going to tell you. This is stage 3, and this is we're going to do this together. And it is way more effective. So this morning when Pete talked about the Old Testament project that we're running at Tyndall House, I'm talking to the team about doing a crowdsourced data project as part of that. I am super excited about that. So from the ridiculous to the sublime, this one is going to scare us all. This is Bright Club. Now, I don't know if you've heard of Bright Club. Okay. Bright Club is where scientists communicate through stand-up comedy. Can you imagine anything more terrifying? So these guys, they're not stand-up comics, they are scientists, but they run these comedy cafe evenings where scientists come and do a 10-minute stand-up comedy slot about their subject. And they range from kind of good to not so good, but, I mean, hats off to these guys. Scary thing to do. The reason is just people say science is boring. Like, how do you make it not boring? You make it funny. Bright Club started in London, but there are now Bright Clubs right across Britain. This is Helen Scales. She is a marine biologist and she is passionate about sharks. So she did her stand-up comedy about sharks, But as she says, there's a serious message behind all of this, which is that each year millions of sharks are caught and killed, but it's hard to raise public sympathy because of widespread and irrational fear about sharks. I think there is nothing irrational about fear of sharks. But there you go. So, stand-up comedy, maybe that's for you. So this next one is called Planet SciCast. And now this is really interesting. This is run by the Institute of Physics in Britain. And what they wanted to do is to encourage filmmaking that portrayed truth about science. So they wanted to communicate science through filmmaking. So you would think that they would go away and make some films about science, but they didn't. What they did is they ran a competition and invited other people, non-scientists, to go away and make a film about science. Because they know that if you watch a film about science, a short film, you might remember it, you might not. If you make a film about science, you are always going to remember that science. You know, you're going to get your family involved. So there was a category for children, a category for schools, a category for adults, and a category for other. If you're not a child and you're not an adult, I don't know what that is. But anyway, there was. And they got 500 entries from across Britain for this competition. And they were just some really extraordinary ones. And again, children, you know, it was really an opportunity for children to get involved in science. So that is Planet SciCast. The next one. This is Science in the Sand. So this was done in Brighton, and a group of neuroscientists went down on the beach and they did science sculpture. So these are neuroscience, these are brain scientists. It was quite amazing. So they did a sculpture of them. Yeah, you can really see where this is going, can't you? Yeah. That is an anatomically correct sand sculpture of a brain. Like, why did they do that? It was really interesting. So the scientific team behind this, they said this: we chose a busy Saturday, and myself and a few sculptors set off to make an anatomically correct brain in the sand. As things started to take shape, we were inundated with people coming to talk to us, from children who wanted to know what happened in the visual cortex of people who are blind, like only in Brighton would you get children asking that, to passing neuroscientists. We had planned to show a time lapse of the tide coming in and slowly degrading the brain, but the tides didn't play ball, so we had to save that for another day. But the point of this was, first of all, that they just rocked up doing something crazy and waited for people to come and talk to them, and they did. So it's actually a little bit like open-air campaigning that Christians do. But I thought that was fascinating, and clearly they did. I mean, clearly passers-by came up to them and said, what are you doing? And then they got the chance to talk about neuroscience. The other purpose behind this was that they did it as a time-lapse video. So you could kind of see it happening, you know, in shot by shot. And then, of course, that was something that they could share on social media and you know, kind of put up on their blogs, send to schools. But apparently that is an anatomically correct brain. And finally, so this is a slightly different one from the creativity, but I think this is a really, really interesting topic for us to consider more clearly. And some of you will know much more about than I do about this. This was an article in Wired magazine about how AI bots are poised to really take hold in journalism. You know, this idea that actually you can just set up an algorithm that can write news stories. And what does that mean for the future of journalism? And that's coming just as much to faith journalism as it is coming to science journalism. There is something called electronic laboratory notebook that some scientists now use. So when they're doing their experiments in a lab, I don't know much about science, and when they're doing their experiments, they take down their notes, and then at the end of it, they hit a button, and it will produce their research paper automatically. Scientists I've spoken to say you have to go through and kind of check it, but usually edits are minimal, that they will create that research paper automatically. Then you hit another button and it creates a press release for you. Then you hit another button and it creates the news story for you. And that is all automated with AI algorithm. So this is really something that is coming down the line for us as media practitioners. So how do scientists respond? By analysing it to death. This was one of the papers that I've seen about how science journalists and scientists should respond to what they see as the inevitability of, you know, science bots sweeping through science journalism. And what I thought was really interesting about this was actually how positive the scientist was. Essentially, he just thought, this is going to happen. Like, there is no use crying about it. How do we shape it so that it does what we want? Actually, if we're concerned about the decline of science journalists, maybe this is a good thing, you know. So there is some really serious study going on by science communicators about how we can take this movement within media of artificial intelligence and then try and harness it and think, well, let's direct it. Let's get right ahead of the curve. And so we can be pushing this in the direction that we want it to go. And I wonder what, you know, what the analogous situation is for us. You know, this is coming across journalism. How can we get right ahead of that curve and say, where do we want faith journalism to go? And how can we harness this to push it in that direction? Because I don't know, I mean, it'd be really interesting to talk afterwards about how much this is talked about in different contexts. I showed this to my husband, actually, and he said, you do know that there was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about an earthquake that didn't happen, that was written by a bot, which got hold of the wrong end of the stick. So I think we've got a little bit of time yet before all our jobs are taken away. But the theory is it's coming down the line to us. So the last thing I'd like to talk about before we just break for more questions, if anyone has any, is evaluation. And this is something that I really do think is a difference, perhaps, between the way that we do communication as Christians and the way scientists do communication. So scientists obviously are used to rigor and evaluation within the scope of their discipline, and they have absolutely brought that through into the way that they do communication. There's all sorts of, I've got a link actually to the Institute of Physics website where it has all sorts of communication. They're all evaluated in exactly the same way that a scientist would evaluate their experiments. So this was a campaign to educate people about physics, and it was called Thank Physics. And the aim of this was that people could look at everyday things around them and know that basically they're only there because of physics. And this is the evaluation ran to pages. What they did was they put like little messages on beer mats and left them in pubs. And so they did that and left them around for people to kind of pick up and read. And there was a question on one side, and then on the other side was a QR code. And you snap the QR code and it would give you the answer to the question on the front of the beer mat. So they did this. And then when they'd finished, they did the evaluation. And I've only just got a couple of slides, but in order to do the evaluation, they went into pubs afterwards and they did interviews with individuals and groups and staff, and a couple where they did an interview with the whole pub and got everyone to get involved to evaluate, are the beer mats working? They did a total of 200 face-to-face interviews and 121 online surveys. And then they crunched the data to know, is this working? And I think, how often do we do that as Christian communicators? Do we do rigorous follow-up and find out, actually, this is the message we want to give. This is the audience we want to give it to. Did it get through? Or do we sort of just, you know, put our communication out there and then hope it does its job and walk away? And I think this is really fascinating. So here they are looking at how interesting people found the beer mats by age. They crunched it down into age. And again, That is a breakdown by age on the popularity of the beer mats. And this is another... this is another quite similar one. You can't see them very well, but essentially this was a campaign to try and get children interested in studying physics. And so there was, they put notices on buses and then to try and kind of attract children into doing physics. And the message was, physics is fascinating and physics is driven by curiosity. So they ran this campaign for a few weeks, and then they got an evaluator who travelled on the bus for six consecutive whole days during the campaign and interviewed passengers about the posters. Then the evaluator travelled on the bus for two consecutive days afterwards to get a control sample. And then again, and then they did an online survey. And again, they kind of crunched the data by how interesting they found different posters by age. I think the one thing I would just like to say as we finish is I'm always slightly nervous when I talk in a Christian setting about essentially sort of strategy and tactics. And I think that's because there are two possible dangers. It's like walking a tightrope, and you can fall off one side or you can fall off the other. And I think, you know, you can fall off on one side with this by thinking, great, we have the strategy, we have the tactics, thanks God we can take it from here. I think that's one possible pitfall we could fall into. I think that's pretty unlikely, personally. I don't think that is the pitfall that we're likely to fall into. I think the pitfall we're likely to fall into is to think, our culture is against us. It's okay for scientists because everyone thinks science is cool and they can blow stuff up to make it exciting. Our culture is against us. You know, as Tony was saying, we're trying to be the fixed point as our culture kind of, you know, rushes against us in the opposite direction. So all the strategy and tactics in the world aren't going to help us. And I think that is a grave danger. And I think it gives too much credit to our culture, too much power. I think in spite of all that is ranged against us, the battle belongs to the Lord. And that is why I was so encouraged this morning to hear that I think we have to be really careful that we don't give our culture more credit than it's due. And so in some ways, strategy and tactics are about giving us something to do and to get on with while God does what he wants to do. But I would hope that we can pick them up with encouragement and with hope and with heart and maybe try and look at our communications a little differently, knowing that ultimately God wants to communicate his truth through us.